This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila, and we are Spy Fat Chicks. And we are actually recording from a brand new location. Well, this is one that I scouted out and said we should go for a while, but...
Well, the location's not brand new. It's been here, but us being here is new. We're at a grocery store.
So you might hear carts going by, you might hear tills beeping or whatever, mm-hmm. but we figured, well, we're surrounded by food, and that's pretty good for recording a food podcast. Well, it's kind of like a community room section at the Blah Blah Superstore on Gibb Street. It's meant for if you buy something from the hot deli, which we did, you can come mm-hmm. up here and enjoy your food and look over the railing and oversee everything going on in the grocery store.
It's really cool. They have like a little kitchen classroom here too where you could take classes. They put a schedule out. If you're in the area, the Oshawa area, and you want to learn a little more about cooking, swing by the Loblaws here. They put a schedule out. They give all kinds of kids' classes. They do kids' classes. They do teen classes. They're doing a sushi class that we just missed. We kind of wanted to do it, but we weren't sure if we'd have the money for both of us to do it. We didn't just want to like draw straws and I lose and then I pout or something. So it's a really neat concept. I love the idea that they have that. And I see us taking some classes in the future when time and money permits to do it. They're not cheap. I mean, you're looking about $20 to $30 minimum for each class, but...
Yeah.
I'm sure you learn a lot. You pay for materials, you get to eat your product.
Yeah.
It's all good.
It's a fun class.
Exactly.
I think.
And they do Weight Watchers classes up here, I believe. They do a bunch of other classes up here. They do private
functions.
I believe you can rent it for parties or, you know, those things when someone's going to have a baby.
Baby showers.
Baby showers, yes. This is take two. We tried to record at a coffee shop and it was just too loud. The music
was
drowning us out. It was so weird. Because last time we were there, it was really quiet. This time it was just ruckusy.
Yeah.
That's not a word, but it is now.
It works for me.
So.
But it was. It was extremely loud.
The good news is, whenever we end up having to do a take two for a recording, I think you guys benefit, the listeners, because we're a little more coherent the second time around.
Instead of rambling and crazy and...
Yeah. I think we've rehearsed it a little bit. We know what works and what doesn't, so we're going to give this another shot. We did lie to you last episode. We said we were going to do A Year of Eating Dangerously.
Right.
And I finished the book... just a couple days ago. I gave it to Sheila. She's just started it. I don't want her to power through it, but, and I read another book in that time, and I didn't want to forget what I read in this one, because it's a little bit different. And then in a couple weeks, go to record this one and sit here and go, oh, I don't remember. So we decided to reverse the order. I'm going to talk about The Gospel of Food a little bit, and then next time we'll record
You're Eating Dangerously.
So
Tracy's the one that's actually read the book. I'm just providing pithy comments.
Yes. Well, I'm kind of telling you about it, and that I'm telling our listeners, but since we've already gone through this before, you understand the topics in here
right.
are just ripe for conversation. There's so much craziness and so much just stuff. It's a good book. I've given it 3 stars on Goodreads. I think I'm going to go back and give it 4 now that I talk about it more and think about it. I shorted the book. I slighted it. And I think I let some of the reviews I read ahead of time influence me a little bit. And I did read some negative reviews about the readability of the book from a literary perspective. And it does jump all over the place. It does feel like it could have been made into 3 books. There's so much material here. He really could have spread it out. And it almost doesn't seem connected, but it is. But first, a little bit about the author. Now, Mr. Barry Glassner here, he is not a food critic. He's not a culinary dude. He is actually a sociology professor. Professor. He's a professor of sociology. I want to say right now in the University of Southern California, somewhere in that area.
Okay.
You know, the trendy part of the country. Mm. And his claim to fame is way back in the day, around 2002-ish, 2004-ish, he wrote a book called The Culture of Fear. And it's about how fear is used to manipulate the public. Not like a propaganda thing, but how like the 6 o'clock news does the fear.
Right.
That we hate. We hate pushing fear.
Yeah. Less V for Vendetta style and more, probably, I don't know.
Less of a case of, what are your children eating? News at 6.
Right.
And more the case of, make sure they eat vitamins and things. So.
Right.
So he spreads the same kind of thing, but from a culinary perspective, in The Gospel of Food. I do want to go back and read The Culture of Fear sometime. Probably won't do a podcast on it, but I'm kind of curious now because I'm so anti-fear as a news technique anyway.
Right. It sells copies.
Yes.
You know.
And you can kind of divide this book into 3 categories. There's the category of food and health and how it relates. Food is pitched as almost like a drug now. We think we could fix what's wrong with us by eating the right foods. Then there's a whole separate section just about restaurants and fast food and hot cuisine and those sorts of things. And by hot cuisine, I don't mean H-O-T cuisine, like lean cuisine. Hot cuisine, like the French word hot.
H-A-U-T-E?
Yes. And then the third one's all about obesity and food and what we think we know about it and we don't. And this book sets out to dispel a lot of myths.
Okay.
It reads kind of like an episode of Penn & Teller show.
BS?
Yes. Or bullcrap, or you can go look up the real show's name. Because we're not going to swear, because we want to keep a clean rating on this one, because it's full of good stuff, and you can listen to it with your preteens, and maybe they'll learn something. Or they'll just ignore it and play DS or something, I don't know. So, anyway, to tackle the first one about food and health, he really hammers on organics a little bit, about whether or not organics are really what we think they are anymore, because we have this image of the family farm with mom churning the butter out back, and dad and son plowing, and sister picking corn, and...
Right.
And it's
feeding
not...
chickens.
And... Yeah. And that's not always organic. Organic food can be factory farmed. Organic food can be made under miserable conditions. The farmers can still be treated like crap. It's not what we're being pushed to believe. Now, local
right.
food, on the other hand, a lot of those folks don't bother to get the organic label because maybe they use a pesticide that's like Roundup or something. It's not mm-hmm. that bad. Or maybe they just don't want to deal with the paperwork. The paperwork to get, at least in the States, the organic designation is intense. And it's a pain in the neck. And most farmers don't have the time for it. They're busy,
yeah.
you know,
farming.
Growing food. Farming and picking things and plowing things and that sort of stuff. Worrying about Monsanto coming up behind them and doing bad things to them.
So, right.
people, so they don't really have the time to apply for it. And Jesse, our garden ninja, had tapped an article. She'd put it on Facebook, and she felt bad. She realized it was a year old, but I'd never seen it before.
No,
and
it was news to me.
And it was all about organic food kind of versus local, and how local food kind of is organic, but it doesn't bother to get the designation.
Right.
It was like that.
And how organic food isn't necessarily a responsible environmental choice
exactly.
or a green choice versus something that's local.
Mm-hmm.
One example of that would be, you know, tomatoes that were grown in South America that are shipped all the way up here that are organic. Well, that's a lot of jet fuel to be, or boat fuel to be shipping that amount when we can grow tomatoes here just fine.
Exactly.
Right in your backyard or right down the road or mm-hmm. just outside your city, there's tomatoes there waiting to be had.
If it comes down to, even from California, an organic tomato from California versus one that doesn't have the organic designation that's grown in Ontario, I'm going to go for the Ontario tomato every single time.
Right. At least it came from closer.
It'll taste better. Because it's fresher. Fresher equals tastier. Unless it's like some crazy game meat, like pheasant, that needs to be hung so it ripens or something. We're not talking about those
right.
weird little exceptions to the rule. But usually local means fresher, which means tastier. Go with that. So he tackles that a little bit, but then... Now, the first time we talked about this, I completely forgot this section, and it's critically important because he kicks the book off with it, about how we don't really know what food does to us. And we think eating, like, the egg scare. We
right.
talked about...
They're bad for you.
Yes.
Now they're good for you.
Now they're bad for you.
Oh,
no, they're still good. We don't know
yeah.
what causes LDLs and HDLs to go up and down in our bloodstream. We don't know what meat really does. Some people can eat all the meat they want, and their cholesterol never goes up. Some people look at an egg, and their cholesterol shoots through the roof.
Right. I mean,
it's just
there's always
know.
Those stories about the people that live to be like 101 and they, you know, smoke 2 packs a day and they eat fat back sandwiches and they're happy as a pig in slop
mm-hmm.
and they live to be forever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then there's people that they exercise, they eat all the vegetables, you know, everything like that, and they still end up dropping
cool.
dead at 50 or something.
And at the end of the book, we're going to talk about those people too. So, does this cause heart disease? Does that prevent heart disease? Does this chemical really do what we think it does? We don't know. But all these foods take these labels and push them like crazy. They do studies so they can put on there that this may reduce your risk of cancer, this may reduce your risk of heart disease, this will increase your good cholesterol.
It's like the antioxidant craze going on right now, you know, with acai berries and
mm-hmm.
blueberries, and the more purple it is, the better it is for you. And
but the question is it like corn and lime, where if you don't have what's in the fruit, is it really going to unlock those antioxidants?
Yeah.
We think it may. We don't know.
What she's referencing is unless you cook corn in an alkali solution, you don't actually unlock a lot of the nutrition, so it just is really good tasting fiber.
Mm-hmm. Whereas,
as far as I know.
Yes.
From what I've been told.
But in a roundabout way, he kind of postulates with some of these the supplements and foods that are enhanced with vitamins, enhanced with all that other crap or
yeah,
stuff.
Enriched.
Enriched. Are we really actually absorbing some of those? Is
or
it really
do
doing us any good?
The...
Or is it just water soluble and we're just peeing it right out?
Right.
Yeah, because there's some chemicals that you need dairy to absorb it properly.
Yeah.
I don't remember what vitamin it is, but there's one you need it with dairy to really absorb it properly. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. There's a couple other that are like that. That if you could take all the vitamin supplements in the world, it's not going to help you. Some of those are dangerous. Some of the supplements, if you have too much of them, they're going to hurt you.
Oh, you can kill yourself by eating too much vitamin K.
Yes.
It's actually deadly. You only need a little bit. I mean, you do need it, but just a dab will do you kind of thing.
And one of the stories that Mr. Glassner relates is he went to his doctor, and his cholesterol was up, and he asked his doctor, oh, should I be eating differently? And his doctor just kind of looked at him like he was a med student and was like, no, we don't know what causes it. Here's a prescription for a cholesterol-lowering drug, and just, you should be fine.
Right.
I think he said stress would be more of an issue than anything else. Let me check, though.
Well, that ties into, as well, that study from the book you were talking about the first time we recorded, where women that liked what they ate seemed to get more nutrition from the
food. From it. Yeah, one study. They were absorbing more iron when they enjoyed the food. When they didn't enjoy the food, they didn't absorb nearly as much iron.
Right.
It was just crazy that attitude may actually influence this. Maybe we should be eating things that we enjoyed. It's just crazy stuff.
Which, like, it begs the question, you know, if you eat a bacon and tomato sandwich, you know, or a BLT, do you get more nutrients from that because you love it than trying to force yourself to eat a salad that you don't particularly care for, you know?
Here's the section. I asked if I should change my diet, and in response, he took out a pad and scribbled a prescription for a cholesterol-lowering drug while instructing me, in a wearied voice, as if to a medical student who had asked a dumb question, that changing my diet probably will not help my heart or any other organ, and I should eat what I want to eat. Like, that runs counter to everything. When my dad had his first heart attack, I mean, the doctor just came down on everything on his diet. No, eat this. No, don't eat that. Blah, blah, blah. My mom, like, went through the house like a tornado, made us finish up all kinds of different foods before he came through from the hospital, replaced everything with all this healthy stuff.
Right.
Like the healthy cookies and the low cholesterol, this. And they didn't buy whole milk anymore. They switched to 2%, which I don't like milk anyway, but I think 2% is even worse. If I can drink anything, it's whole milk at least, because it has something resembling flavor.
Right.
And he talks about that. About how, you know, fat may be good for us. French cholesterol and how their health is, and they eat all these fatty foods. And there's even a little bit of a hypothesis that things like foie gras and the natural animal fats work on their metabolism in France. Like olive oil works on a Mediterranean metabolism. Not that there's a difference between the metabolisms, but the natural animal fats may be increasing the good, which one's good, LDL or
HDL?
I don't
remember. Well, the good cholesterol.
The good one. And maybe lowering the bad, just like olive oil does it. We don't, and there's more studies that just came out this year about that.
People are genetically predisposed to it, or if it's attitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could totally get into the nature versus nurture thing.
Yes.
Maybe the reason why the French are so, or have so much less heart attacks, exactly, is because they sit there and they leisurely eat. They don't cram a 15-minute luncheon at the desk, not even leaving the office and then getting back to work.
Like he puts it, you don't have to eat. It's terrible to look at food and say, I have to eat. No, I want to eat. I enjoy eating. I get to eat. It's a privilege.
Yay!
You know, it's the same exact attitude.
There's a difference between treating food like something to be enjoyed and food as fuel, right?
Well, they did a study, too. You're going to hear me say that, like, that's the drinking game for the episode. When I say they did a study, take a shot.
Yeah.
But he backed up,
I know you can pretty much get statistics to back up anything, but you did say that there is a very good bibliography at the back of this book
everything. Everything is academically done. It shows, I was surprised, because most of the food culture kind of books we read don't have that, but this fellow is a true, you know, to the bone academic, and he does his homework and he does it well.
Right.
You can still pick studies that reflect what you want. The perfect example is, we're going to take a little history lesson here for 5 minutes. Way back in the day, in the early 1900s, Pittsburgh was a hole full of filthy immigrants who were dying left and right of things like malaria and that sort of deal.
Dysentery.
It was just horrible living conditions. Think like Chicago and the jungle kind of stuff. The same time that they were doing all the progressive movements with Hull House, Pittsburgh, the university there had sponsored, not really the university, but some of the people in the area had sponsored something called a survey to go in and find out what was wrong with the city and how we can correct it in terms of our living conditions. And they ended up publishing this huge set of volumes about what was wrong with Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And they came up with some of the worst horror stories you could imagine about living conditions, tenement housing, working conditions, how families are having a hard time getting by, they were immigrants, how the immigrant workers were treated. Everything you could think about that's bad, all the horror stories from movies you think of, they're there.
Yeah.
And the one newspaper funded by, I don't remember the company right now, which is terrible, but funded by some of the capitalists, the robber barons in Pittsburgh, ended up doing a rebuttal to the survey where they went out and picked out everything that was good in Pittsburgh and all of the opportunities immigrants had and all of this that was shining and wonderful, and it's really not that bad. So depending on which one you read determines whether or not you think at the time, 1909 to 1912, in Pittsburgh was a horrible place to be or a great place to be. The same thing. Whether or not you look at this or another study determines whether or not you think something is unhealthy. Which one's right, we still don't know. And that is something he pushes. We just don't know. Are we torturing ourselves and possibly damaging ourselves by not eating things we enjoy, is that causing more damage, or are we actually doing the right thing? We don't know.
There are still a lot of things that are unexplained in this world. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, space exploration is neat, but we still haven't even explored our own oceans yet. So it doesn't surprise me that even in this scientific age, mm-hmm. and we're still kind of riding the end of the Age of Enlightenment, we still really don't know how our own bodies work. I mean, we just unlocked the DNA code, what, 10, 15 years ago?
Not even. We're still working on that. We just unlocked it in the late 90s, I think. Early 20th century. Yeah, there's so much we still don't understand how it works.
It's a world of mystery.
And there's even more about that with the Bee Simulator that just... the whole book made my head hurt. Because it really takes everything you think you know. And I feel like I'm a savvy consumer.
Right.
I feel like I understand what I should and shouldn't eat for our health. Of the two of us, I'm the one who pushes, no, really, we shouldn't eat fast food every day. It's not that good for us. I'm the one, I think, who's a little more paranoid about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more laissez-faire,
and this,
say.
I think, has had me back off a little bit. Just like chocolate. They did a study that chocolate eaters live longer. Why? We don't know. It could be because we enjoy it. It could be...
a chemical that's in the chocolate.
It could be the chemical that's in it. We just don't know. But I thought, yeah, you know, I shouldn't deny myself all the good stuff in life. Screw it. I'm going to eat some chocolate. When I crave it, I'm going to have it. Moderation in everything.
So, including moderation.
Including moderation. Sometimes you have to go over the edge there.
Sometimes you have to party. I mean, what's life if you don't have a good time once in a while, right?
And he also introduces a word that was never in my vocabulary before. Treif. T-R-E-Y-F. And it's a Yiddish thing. It's supposed to be non-kosher ingredients. Something that's not kosher.
Okay.
And there's such a thing as safe treif. And safe treif is like Chinese food, because the pork and shrimp and things that you're not supposed to have for somebody who's not closely keeping kosher, you don't really notice it, because it's indistinguishable from anything else in, like, your chop suey or whatever you're getting. And he uses treif and safe treif throughout the book. So that's a concept you want to pick up on early. But it just... he takes the health stuff and segues right into how we're pushed to believe these foods will make us feel better. And it's all marketing. It may not actually do it. There was the thing about oat bran, which was really big in the mid-80s. They thought oat bran was going to reduce cholesterol. And
oh, yeah, I remember that. There was all these... there was oat bran in everything. Mm-hmm. There was, like, new oat bran cereals. Quaker Oats got, like, the new updated image, you know, to make them more modern instead mm-hmm. of so stuffy that it's just something for old people. And I remember there was this Canadian... I can't even remember what the name of the cereal was, so I guess the commercial didn't really work that well. But there was this old Scottish guy, and they give him a bowl of oatmeal. He's like, "Wait, oatmeal should be thick enough to stop a bullet." And they give him a bowl of this oatmeal cereal, and he's like, "Well, it's good, but it's not oatmeal."
It came out later on that in the 90s that oat bran doesn't really lower cholesterol. It decreases it so modestly that really you can't say that anymore. Hmm. So Quaker Oats wasn't going to give up that great sweet thing they could put on their packaging that sells right. tons and tons of oat everything.
Especially with all the hippie resurgence going on.
Well, because they were adding oat bran to everything.
Yeah.
So Quaker pretty much sponsored a Harvard survey study, and it was able to petition the FDA. So pretty much they paid lots of money to get this study to say that it still reduces cholesterol, so they can still put it on the packaging.
It's inconclusive at best.
And here's the part that needs read aloud, because it is so important to remember when you see all these incredible claims on food packaging. And thanks to legislations and lawsuits engineered by the food and dietary supplement industries, the FDA is largely powerless to reject petitions from food makers who selectively cite studies in support of their claims while ignoring studies that contradict them. So think of the doctor from Simpsons. Hi, everybody, I'm Dr.
Hi, Dr. Nick. Dr.
Nick. Yes, that guy can do a study and get them to say that high fructose corn syrup is the elixir that will cure everything.
In fact, it'll reverse aging.
Yes, it'll make you an old baby again. So just keep that in mind. Obviously, nobody's going to believe that, but some of the other things, you know, you don't know. They could come out with something tomorrow saying the potato board, or whatever it's called, could say potatoes starch is going to reverse the effects of aging and reduce wrinkles and make your skin luster more. You should eat more potatoes.
Right.
And get somebody to do a study where it comes out in their favor. And he also tackles them here on the study end, that some of those studies are in doubt, period, when they talk about nutrition and consumption, because they remove smokers from the statistics when they're doing heart disease and that, because smokers skew the statistics so much.
Right.
Because we know smoking causes heart disease. We know there's a strong connection there. We know it causes a lot of other ill health effects. So when they remove out of a study of 100,000, they remove 60,000 of the people, and you're left with 40,000, it takes fewer people to bump the percentage up.
Well, and then too, that is totally bogus, because how do they know then how, well, the substance in question affects people that are intaking those toxins in their body?
Well, I'm sure they do a separate study for that, but when they're pushing the whole, this reduces this, or this increases, this food increases your cholesterol, or is going to kill you dead, or makes heart disease happen, the statistics are so skewed because they reduce smokers from most of the studies.
That's crazy.
It is. We don't know. We've crippled ourselves in terms of the research. They don't go and get a larger sample. They just make do with the small sample. And anybody
so
who knows statistics...
it's not a true scientific study, then, at all.
No, because that may be what causes it. Those people may be genetically predisposed to it. If you have 10 people in a study and 6 of them die from something, you could say, ooh, a 60% death rate. This is very bad. We shouldn't eat this. If you have 1 million people in a study and 6 of them die, it's infinitesimally smaller.
Right.
You look at it and say, yeah, it's not a big deal.
That's less than a 1% chance.
Yes. So, good stuff there, but we're going to totally switch gears now, and, irradiation.
Oh.
I want to do more research on irradiation. He talks about how irradiation completely prevents foods from being able to be organic. It's, nobody wants to eat irradiated food, but we don't know why. It kills everything.
It's a psychological thing.
Well, irradiation will kill everything that's bad in it. You
make
your produce
last
safe
forever.
Again.
Yeah.
And one of the things I want to ask Aubrey is whether or not irradiation will fix things like E. coli that gets into plants.
Right.
But I think from what he says here, it really leads me to believe it does render everything safe. It kills all the bugs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody wants it.
I've read articles about it. Yeah, because they're afraid that it's going to, make your pee glow green or whatever.
They think you're going to get cancer from it. Now,
and in actual fact, that's not the case at all, from what I understand.
Back in the day, when I was a wee little baby Tracy, and I thought I wanted to go into the heart sciences and be a horticulturalist, I went to governor's school. We talked about that in another episode. We did a little unit at the power plant. Well, not power plant, the research facility, the nuclear research facility on campus. Yes, Penn State main campus has a little mini nuclear reactor. It's very pretty. It glows blue.
It's a cobalt reactor.
Yeah,
right?
It's the bluest blue I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
I've never seen a blue like that in nature before. Very interesting. And they had a bag of strawberries, 2 bags of strawberries on the table. One looked like sludge. One looked fresh and ready to eat. And they were doing studies on irradiating food. This is in 94.
Okay.
And they said, you know, what's the difference? We're like, well, that obviously is rotten. That's still good. They said these strawberries were picked at the same time. They're the same age. They said about 3 weeks old.
Okay.
This is obviously no longer good. You can't keep strawberries that long. This one was irradiated. It killed everything that was in it, and now the food lasts longer. And we all just kind of sat there and said, well, why don't we do this all the time? They said, well... And they kind of laid it out. People were afraid of it.
Yeah. Most people that are my age and your age remember what the Cold War was like.
Mm-hmm.
And most people that are our age probably had nightmares about the nuclear Armageddon. There's something that will not go away in our lifetime. People that are younger than us, they don't really have that kind of connection. So maybe in their lifetime, we'll be able to proceed by using nuclear and irradiated things in a more free and unbiased way. But right now you have so many hippies that are like, not in my backyard, with nuclear power and nuclear warheads. And
now, here's how I propose it. And I may be wrong, it may be a different kind of radiation, but let's assume cannibalism is perfectly legal. Somebody who's had an x-ray, do you think you're going to get cancer if you eat them?
That's a totally crazy example, but I totally see what you're saying.
Yeah, you're not. It's a completely different thing. The gamma rays pass right through. It doesn't leave anything behind. You can test it with a Geiger counter. It's safe. I am becoming a proponent of irradiating food, and I'm sure it's going to upset a lot of people who are really into the natural thing. The only thing that stops me from being really gung-ho about it is something else he proposed in this book. Just because we can put a Band-Aid on it to fix it doesn't mean we should allow these conditions to continue that makes food unsafe to the point we need to irradiate it.
That is true.
And that's a great point. We should not put a Band-Aid on it, but nonetheless, if it can keep people from dying, why aren't we doing it?
If it can stop more hunger, because food stores last longer, so that you can ship it to places where it's needed.
Yes.
I don't know, it's crazy, it's a touchy subject. I don't figure that they're making the radioactive isotopes just for this.
No.
I'm guessing this is a byproduct of something else that you're already doing
or
in the lab
already
anyway.
Or it already exists,
exactly.
But radiation's a good thing, and I also think we're going to see a shift in our paradigm, hopefully, maybe within our lifetimes, of radiation being viewed as a good thing because of cancer treatment.
Yeah.
Because you go in to be irradiated to help kill cancer.
Most people are more scared of the chemotherapy than I think they are of the
but
cancer.
It's not the same thing as radiation treatment. Radiation treatment is separate from chemo.
Okay.
radiation is.
See, it's always been linked for me.
It is.
So, well, I guess that's linked in mm-hmm. a lot of people's psyche then, not just me.
No, I thought it was the same thing until I talked to my mom, and she said she had to do chemo and radiation. I said, isn't that the same thing? And she said, no. Chemo is when they put the chemicals in that kill things. Chemo, chemical therapy.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's when you get the drip and it makes you really sick because it's literally
poison.
And it makes you lose your hair. Radiation doesn't make you lose your hair. It's a different kind of therapy that it literally is using radiation waves.
That's what it is. That's what ties it together mm-hmm. because people that are exposed and have radiation sickness lose their hair, their teeth fall out.
No,
which
chemo
makes
may
sense
involve
why...
some form of radiation, the chemical,
right.
I don't know. But I do know that the radiation is a separate treatment because she was looking forward to the radiation treatment, but the radiation treatment I do not believe is as traumatic
invasive.
To her body as the chemo. I may
be
wrong.
That makes sense for people that get chemotherapy don't lose their
teeth.
But they lose their hair.
Because you think protein and all that, yeah.
Yeah.
So, back to this, he does also say he went to a food safety summit in 2002, and he ate a rare hamburger because they had irradiated the meat first, so it was safe to eat rare burgers again.
Well, all right.
I thought that's kind of neat. So, very cool stuff there.
It is.
Totally switching gears and running into the middle section of the book here. And I'm leaving a lot out. It's a neat book. And it's actually, I got it on discount at Chapters. It's been out long enough. It's being marked down and shuffled off. Maybe there's a new edition coming out or a trade paperback. I don't know. Check Half Price. Check your local Chapters. You can pick it up for like $6 now in hardback.
Yeah.
It's a total steal.
Well, it seems like it's got some really interesting ideas.
Mm-hmm. The meat of the book for us, the part that I really enjoyed as we're not going to say wannabe food critic, but as somebody who's a food person.
I even had shuddered, I'm even reluctant to say foodie, because
mm-hmm.
that comes with a whole bunch of baggage, too.
Yeah, I just like food. But as somebody who enjoys food, enjoys reading things about food, the midsection of Restaurant Heaven, The Food Adventurers, and Restaurant Hell, this could have been its own book. It could have been expanded out. I would have happily read it over and over. Restaurant Heaven tackles hot cuisine. It tackles the high-end restaurants. It tackles all the myths and misconceptions, which aren't many, that go with it, and how that kind of works. And these are places Sheila and I will never go to, not just because of the price. You kind of hit that price ceiling where if I'm paying $100 for a plate, is it really that good compared to $20 something someplace else? You have to ask yourself that. Unless the head chef, the big star, is there actually cooking your food, which he's usually not, then no, it's not worth that. You're not getting the Mona Lisa, you're getting a reproduction of the Mona Lisa. So, Glassner's not a food critic, he goes to places, he's not recognized, he gets served and treated like a normal person. And he said the difference between going and doing that and going with food critics who are recognized was night and day. They got better seats, the food was immeasurably better, the service was just up your butt.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. And it's because restaurants put a lot into identifying the food critics and making sure they're happy.
Right.
They do the crazy James Bond spy stuff. They have files and pictures and notes all over the place. If these people come in, this is what they like, this is what they don't like. There are some restaurants that even do it for VIPs, not just food critics.
Right.
Where if this person likes to take a smoke break between each course, they make sure the courses to come out slower so they have time to go have a cigarette or whatever.
Kind of like Thomas Jefferson's
dinner parties. Yes.
Where you'd made sure not to seat people next to people that they would find annoying. And
mm-hmm. He was a very accommodating dinner host, and it's the same thing, is that these are accommodating restaurant hosts to very so-called important people.
Right.
And by very important people, we don't mean like diplomats and politicians and
we're
Nobel
talking
laureate
like celebrities.
Scientists. Yeah, we mean like, I don't know.
People with money.
Yes. Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enough said about that, but it's interesting to see that. And you kind of think, wow, what a waste that these poor food critics go to incredible lengths to be anonymous in the restaurants to know who they are.
They have like disguises and stuff.
Yeah, and the restaurants know what their disguises are. They trade notes with each other. They keep up on who's what critic. And the restauranteurs say, well, if this person can crush my restaurant, I want to do everything within my power to make sure they're happy. I want to make sure they get good service and good food. You can say, well, that's crappy. Why don't you treat everybody at your restaurant like that? That should be your motto. I treat everybody great.
That was what I was thinking, mm-hmm. Wouldn't it just be safer and easier and less intense to just give the best service and the best food every time?
You would think that, but apparently not. So they go through these links, but the flip side is, and some of the restaurant critics propose this to them, that 90% of what makes a food meal great or what goes on happens before they step foot in the restaurant. The chef doesn't know they're coming that day. Whether or not the food's been bought, what food's been bought, and the quality of it's already been done. done. The sauces have already been prepared. The menu's already set. That sort of thing.
That's true.
The recipes are already done. The only difference is if the head chef is there, who's usually the big star, the big name, like Wolfgang Puck or something, they will go out and handle the dish personally. Which
right.
means the difference between it being eh and oh my god amazing, because again you have like the grandmaster doing it.
Right.
And I also liked how he, Glasner proposed that, and I think he got it from somebody else, he was talking about somebody else, he was citing them, that this style of culinary art is the last patronage art.
That's true.
And we had talked about how there's right. no patronage system anymore. You don't have artists and sculptors who are supported solely by like a really rich family like the Hiltons.
Or the church.
Or the church to do things.
Yeah,
you're
that's the trade-off you get to have total freedom as an artist. We don't have patrons anymore telling us what to paint or giving us money to paint.
Mm-hmm. You're more commercial. Like
yeah.
Larry Elmore, he has to sell his paintings to fantasy companies that are looking for a specific type of artwork, or they commission him to make something for their game or their magazine or book or whatever. But
right.
it's not nearly what it used to be back like in the Renaissance, even up through the 1800s, where you would have
right.
a artist that was kind of like your family's artist that did all your portraits. You patronize them.
That's true.
But this, we do. These famous people go to these restaurants and patronize them and pretty much support the restaurant, because the food doesn't cost that much to make, but it's a form of art that's still being supported by the elite.
Hmm.
Which is an interesting concept.
It is.
I don't ever want to enter that world. I don't care if we win the lottery tomorrow. I don't ever want to be a part of it, because it's just so full of pretension and snobbery that it just I wouldn't enjoy it. And even the restaurants, most of these restaurants are about making an incredible type of food, making an incredible dish. And it's hard to get seated, and it's kind of like going to Studio 54 back in the day. Ooh, I got in. I'm so cool. But there are some of them that are out there just to be trendy. There was one in particular that he talked about that I just thought was reprehensible for a chef of that caliber, where he only hires pretty model-style people.
Right.
He is the same restaurant that was featured on the reality show, The Restaurant. Chatero. Yeah, Chatero. Let me see if I can find the fellow's first name. He's a famous chef, and they just want the place to be trendy. That's what the place is all about. They
it's not
the
about
playlist
the food.
Regularly. It's not about the food. It's about getting in there, being seen there. He wants it to be the hot spot in town, and it is. And they aired this show, this horrible reality show that just was on NBC. It was so contrived. It was so engineered. They did multiple shots of dramatic moments so they could have things to splice together, like when the one waitress walked off the show and everything.
Right.
And they don't care about the food. And the guy even gets mediocre food reviews because he's so worried about the rest of his image that he's not concerned about what really matters in a restaurant like that. And at least the other hot cuisine restaurants, I have respect for them because they are working with their craft.
Yeah.
Granted, they don't have their hands in there all the time. They're going here, doing this, doing that, putting a bit of attention on the sauce here and this, but they're not making the dish like they used to and really giving everybody a Mona Lisa. But that's the trade-off to have that kind of restaurant.
Right.
But this guy, it's just, you suck.
You're
charging $100, $200 for something that really isn't even worth $20 because
right.
you suck. I know, I've never eaten it. I shouldn't be that harsh on it, but to put yourself out there like a restaurant, and you want to do that, do a nightclub. You know what? If you want that kind of image and that kind of notoriety, do a nightclub. Don't put yourself into the culinary world.
I can't remember if it was on Penn Jillette's radio show where there was the topless donut bar or the topless donut place.
I don't know. I don't even remember that.
Okay. Well, it reminds me of this. Basically, it was this old guy in Vegas, I think, that has this topless donut and coffee shop, and he hires great-looking women to mm-hmm. walk around, you know, in bikinis, bottoms, and they have these trays and trays of donuts. And he actually doesn't make any money on it because he ends up having to, like, put out all the money for the donuts because he doesn't
nice.
Make his own donuts there. You go in the back and there's, like, boxes and boxes and boxes from some other donut place, right?
Mm-hmm. That's insane. That's awesome.
Oh. I imagine it's fun, but mm-hmm. I guess it's not very profitable. Or it's not as profitable as you would think it would be anyway.
Mm-hmm. But it's just some of these restaurants, they really go out of their way to make the VIPs happy because that's who patronizes them and pays the incredible amounts of money for the food. And I don't really know if it's worth it. Why aren't you focusing on your craft? There is a restaurant, though, he talks about in Los Angeles. Chef Suzanne Goyne. That name sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
It's the restaurant AOC, which is supposed to be amazing. It's Mediterranean dishes in French charcuterie. Charcuterie. It's supposed to be really good. Anyway, she has gotten piles and piles of crap because she doesn't cater to VIPs. You make your reservation, you get your table. There's no special treatment.
So, as far as restaurant critiquing goes, it's not what you know, it's
yeah.
who you know.
They've got
how much you're willing to kiss up.
Her and the business partner apparently have gotten tons and tons of crap from big name people in Hollywood. It's a West Coast restaurant, but right. How they couldn't get a table and don't you know who I am and I'll never eat in your restaurant and I'll ruin you. And they're like, yeah, whatever.
They're still going.
Yeah, and it's just great. Whereas Wolfgang Puck apparently caters just kowtows to his famous patrons and goes crazy, and he spends lots of time on the phone every day making sure everything's perfect for his other restaurants in the country for the VIPs that go there. It just kind of, I have less respect for him going into this book, after reading this book, than I did before, and I have a lot of respect for whoever Chef Suzanne Goyne is, and again, we come into a lot of money someday, and we're out in Los Angeles, I'll wait a week to get a table at her restaurant just because I can, you know? Other places we'll never get into. Back to, midpoint of the chunk of really cool food stuff in this one, The Food Adventurers. This is a chapter that kind of pertains to our podcast and us, and it's about authenticity and ethnic cuisine. And how you're never really going to have truly authentic ethnic cuisine because you're not there.
Yeah.
It will never be exactly like it is there. Like you said before about kabocha. Go for that. That
okay.
was awesome.
So this, you can never really have authentic cuisine here because you're not there. And the example that I used was the kabocha. There's a certain terroir, which is the mineral composition of the soil in different places. So here's your choice.
He uses that word too, talking about that.
Oh, okay.
That's awesome.
Well, you hear it used a lot, wine, because I'm like, where you grow things matters.
Yes.
You know, if it didn't, then everything would taste the same everywhere, right? But it doesn't. So, say, for example, I want to have an authentic pickled kabocha sushi roll.
Uh-huh. Or just pickled kabocha for something else.
Or pickled kabocha for something else.
Yes.
I can either get a kabocha on a long, arduous, leaky fishing boat that God knows how long that little kabocha was rolling around on the sea for, and it was probably not picked ripe.
Just imagine, like, an empty cargo hold at the bottom of this huge ship. And there's, like, kabocha rolling back and forth. It's all bruised and mangled and busted up when it gets here. Go ahead.
Or I can take some kabocha seeds and grow them here, which they'll grow here, but it's not going to be the same as if it was grown in Japan because the soil is made up differently.
Uh-huh.
So, really, if I want authentic pickled kabocha, I have to get my butt on a plane, train, or automobile.
I want to see you drive to Japan.
And get myself to Japan, not the other way around. You can't really bring authentic food here. You kind of have to go there to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that we'd like instant gratification, and I know that it's a global world, but there's just some things that you have to go there to get.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't bring the Great Wall to you.
Exactly.
You have to go to it.
Exactly. And it's the same thing. He cites lots of examples about how it's just not going to happen. And also that a lot of the foods that we consider authentic and ethnic specialties are special foods that wouldn't be eaten every day.
Right.
These are festival foods and holiday foods, and you would only eat it like at Sunday dinner maybe for Italian food, or normal everyday food for a lot of these ethnic cuisines are very boring. It's
right.
just like our regular meat and potatoes.
Well, I mean, what did you eat every day for breakfast when you were in China? It wasn't dim sum.
Gruel. Well, I was in the north too. I wasn't in the south, but gruel. It was like this like thick rice porridge stuff that was really bland. But we had the fried scallion pancakes, which kicked butt.
Oh, okay. But still.
Or the fried dough sticks. That's what we had every day.
Right.
No variation.
It would be like people coming here and expecting us to have a 1950s mom change the stove, making us turkey dinners with garlic mashed potatoes and cranberries and pie for dessert every single day.
Exactly. We don't eat like that. We don't have T-bone steaks every night grilled. So it's the same thing. So that also feeds into the whole authenticity myth. And then he talks about Sheila's favorite website ever. And we have to make sure we don't get hate mail on this before we go too crazy, but go ahead.
It's not that I have a problem with the website itself. It's just the reviews on the website that are submitted by the users.
Chowhound.com.
Now, when I picture the Chowhound, I picture this three-headed Cerberus that's going to, like, bite your arm off no matter what you try and feed to it. All you can hear is snapping clavicles. No matter what kind of dish you put in front of the Chowhound, it does not like it.
Yes.
And it is extremely negative about it.
Now, Chowhound, the site, is useful. It's nice to pop on and see what they've said about something. We just have a bad taste in our mouth for it because there have been places we've really enjoyed and we go on there and the reviews are just, nah, it sucked.
It's either mediocre or it's downright negative. And one of the things I do treasure about living where I am and when I am, mm-hmm. is that we have the freedom. There's as many opinions on Earth as there are people. You know, just like when I was in high school, my world religions teacher told me that there's as many gods in the Hindu religion as there are people that practice the Hindu faith. So I really am glad that we have the freedom to all have an opinion. But a lot of people just express negative opinions just to either sound smart because they can critique something, or just because they're negative jerks anyway, and they can't say something nice about it. And snark is hot.
Snark is cool right now.
Yeah.
I hate that. But it's cool to hate everything, and cool to be sarcastic, and cool to be very blasé and say, oh, I've had better, because it makes you sound so cultured and so awesome and
the
so
the smart mouth sidekick is hot, mm-hmm. and we can't stand that.
Mm-mm.
That's part of the reason why we do the podcast the way we do, and we won't do a negative review on a restaurant, because there's already enough negativity in the world.
You don't need us adding to it, though. We've thrown about the idea of maybe a special episode for a milestone. Do
like
some
the 1 year anniversary.
The worst of the worst, or the places that we avoid. Because there have been a lot of places we haven't talked about, where we've walked in and said, oh, this is horrible, and laughed.
Right.
So stay tuned
for that sometime in May, probably.
Future. May or later, we'll see. Anyway, back to this. So there's the Chow Hound. Where the whole point of Chow Hound is to go find these little culinary gems and spread the word about them, but I've never seen them do that. I've only seen them hate on places.
Yeah.
For instance, Mr. Burger. Great burger that's like fast food that isn't fast food. And they hate it.
It's less processed.
Everyone says, oh, it's terrible. Why would you go there? It's good food.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's the best burger I've ever had. I've already told you the best burger I've ever had was at Willie Stout's.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's good food for what you pay. For, you know, $9, two people can get two... to get a bacon cheeseburger. Good stuff.
I mean, I don't know the dude personally, obviously. I just know his public persona. I'm sure Anthony Bourdain is a fine guy. He'd probably like Mr. Burger, but everybody wants to be big, bad Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, after seeing him eat that hot dog slathered in everything when he was it Brazil or Chile?
Yeah, it was like in Chile, and they put like avocado all over and mayonnaise all over the hot dog. I'm sure that he would like Mr. Burger, but everyone wants to be big, bad Anthony Bourdain and have something bad to say about everything.
I really want to read some of his books, too. Mm. So, there's the Chow Hound theory of, you know, we're going to use reviews and do all this other crazy stuff to find it. And I loved another fellow he talked about here that uses what Sheila and I call the Rachel Ray theory. You stop strangers on the street and ask them, hey, where would you eat?
Yeah.
I love that. Whereas he puts it, you stop people who look like you or better fed than you and say, hey, where do you eat?
Yeah, exactly.
And he said it works. It's a poet and an English professor at Florida State. Go David Kirby. You rock.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to find a new place to eat. And you know what? You're probably going to be further ahead than if you go to Chow Hound. Because you're always going to find a negative review about something. And it's going to scare you away from wanting to go anywhere.
It's going to make you have a preconceived idea, too, before you even get a chance to step in the door.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, it should be some place where even little mom-and-pop places can have a web presence.
Mm-hmm.
And having an online presence is important nowadays. And there's a lot of mom-and-pop places that don't have websites or MySpaces or Facebook. So you would think that Chow Hound would at least give, like, that diner on the corner that you love to go to all the time or every Sunday for breakfast. It would give them a little spot.
Exactly. And also...
But all it does is just drag everybody down.
I guess Chow Hound, the guy who founded it, goes on about deliciousness. And the whole point of Chow Hound is to sniff out secret deliciousness and all this other craziness.
Right.
And it's just
It started
really,
with good intentions, I think.
It started with good intentions.
It just
it's
got
not
dragged
what it
down.
Used to be. Yeah. But these folks are going out trying to find the craziest authentic food they can, especially on Chow Hound. And why are they doing it? And there was a perfect... way of putting it, they're looking for a way to be cool. Going out and finding the most authentic, crazy, I'm eating a rat kebab. And it gives you cultural capital, as put by a sociologist he talks about, Pierre Bourdieu.
It gives you a badge to put on your culinary Girl Scout sash.
Yeah, it makes you look cool and it elevates your social status because you're so worldly that you'll go off and eat a rat kebab. Another way to look at it, presented by another sociologist, is that pretty much eating these ethnic cuisines in as natural a setting as you can for what they are, it lets you identify with the oppressed instead of the oppressor, which is supposed to make up for you driving this huge SUV and having this huge house that you can't fill up with anything useful. It's all full of empty crap.
And wearing clothes made in sweatshops, et cetera.
It's an interesting way of putting it. And there are some people who they really go for the crazy stuff just to say they've done it and be cool. We've met some of them. They're okay. And then there's a lot of people who just say, I like different tastes. I want to taste the world. I want to taste everything.
Right.
And they go into it saying, I'm going to give it a shot and see what it's like. I like to think Sheila and I are like that. We don't do it just because, ooh, let's eat something shocking and tell everybody about
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
It's just we genuinely like different
like,
flavors.
I don't do it to be like on a freak show, you know?
Yeah, I'm not going to start, you know, biting the heads off of live cockroaches
right.
or anything.
And the way I look at it is when I go out and try new things, I feel like I can understand the world a little bit better and understand the people in this world a little bit better. And I think that makes me a better person. And I'm not saying saying that I'm better than somebody else, but I'm making myself better for me because I want to be the most worldly person.
You're broadening your horizons because for some bizarre reason that's what you value.
Yeah.
That's all.
That's just a personal thing, you know?
I just like tasty things, and I'm willing to try almost anything to find new tasty things because I enjoy them, and I get excited when I find something really tasty and I can share it with a friend because I'm doing something nice for them. I'm saying, ooh, you have to try this because it may make you just as happy as it made me. Mm-hmm. It's more of a sharing thing. And I like to think we're fairly open-minded, that we can appreciate food for what it is. Just like when we talk about the difference between Flying Fish and Go Believe, two sushi buffets just down the street from each other. We personally prefer Go Believe because they don't use mayonnaise in their rolls everywhere.
Or as much.
And
they have eel on the menu. And
they have eel.
Easy for eel.
It doesn't say we hate Flying Fish. I still like their sushi.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to say their sushi is good. And if you're a person who likes a good bit of mayonnaise in your sushi, you're going to love it.
Exactly.
If you're somebody who likes a drier sushi, you're going to like Go Believe. I may go as far to say Flying Fish may have better nigiri, to be honest.
Yeah.
But we can look at it and evaluate it. Even though personally our tastes don't run towards mayonnaise, we can still say it's good because of this.
Right. And so, I think we're self-aware enough that just because we prefer this style of sushi over that style, that doesn't mean that we're going to sit there and come down on the other place. Because it's fine. It's good food, yeah. You know, and the service is good, and it's got a nice interior.
Oh, yeah,
it's a good
inside.
Restaurant.
It's a nice little place.
Exactly. And just because I found something else, another place that does it a little bit more to my taste,
exactly.
And has different things on the menu that I like, that doesn't mean that I'm going to be down on the other place.
But it's
know?
A self-awareness that enables somebody to give a good review. You can sit down and ask critically, what are you looking to eat? Okay, price is one thing. You want something that's not too greasy, and you want a variety of side dishes. Okay, so you don't want too greasy, but price is important. But greasy's bad, so don't go to Mr. Burger. You want side dishes, so you probably don't want a burrito, so don't go to Viva Burrito. You want Teddy's. They have a nice, not greasy burger with a great selection of side dishes. It's not too expensive. Go for it.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing that you can sit down and say, these are three great places. We're not saying one's above the other. It depends on what you're in the mood for.
Exactly.
We're not saying we love Mexican, so Viva Burrito is the best place in the world. We love Mexican. Viva Burrito is a great place, but it's not the best restaurant in the world. Sorry, Jay. It's great. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But we're willing to be impartial like that. And that, reading this made me feel better about us and how we approach food and how we approach talking about it, too. So I was like, yay, we're doing something right. It's cool. So we're going to switch gears to the last section of the food gear. We're going to kind of kick it up to gear 2.5 and talk about restaurant hell, subtitled The Dissing of McDonald's. And just like how Penn and Teller championed Walmart in an episode, this guy champions McDonald's. And he did it well. He did a great job of it. And I kind of stepped away and said, wow, maybe I'm a little too harsh on McDonald's, too, sometimes. Though I have to say, I have honestly tried their burgers. I don't like them. I just was like looking over my shoulder from like Ronald McDonald standing there with like a truncheon or something.
Grimace is going to be behind you with the taser.
I know.
Zap.
I just don't like McDonald's burgers. They don't taste good to me. They don't taste right. It's not a taste I grew up with, so I can't get into them. I don't really like their fries as much as I like French fries from other fast food establishments. What I do like at McDonald's is their chicken sandwiches. I think they do a bang-up job on their chicken.
You like the fish sandwiches too, do
I like you? Their fish sandwiches. That's a childhood taste for me, because I didn't like burgers as a kid, so I always got a fish sandwich with no tartar sauce. Go figure. Weird child. I know. But it's true. There's other things they have there. So I don't hate the restaurant. I don't hate their philosophy. I wish they were, all of fast food restaurants were a little more forthcoming about posting their nutritional facts. And I'm glad to see they have those on the wrappers now so you can actually see what you're eating.
Yeah.
That makes me happy. Most of my major gripes about McDonald's have gone away. Their salads are darn tasty.
Yeah.
And as long as you watch what you're putting on them, they're still pretty good for you.
The major gripes were they hid the nutritional information, which they took care of.
Mm-hmm.
There was no healthy alternatives, which they took care of.
Mm-hmm. And not even healthy as in, you know, fat-free, everything-free.
Right.
But, you know, we'd like a little more vegetation involved in our diet. Roughage is good.
Yeah, exactly. And they didn't get any ingredients from local places.
And they've
changed
that.
Which they've
changed
that
a lot now.
So they took care of that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Which is a point, one of the defenses he makes in McDonald's is the fact that they're so big. They're one of the biggest, if not the biggest buyer of beef in the world. They can push for reform. And they have.
Yeah.
And they've pushed for better conditions for cattle. They've pushed for better ingredients. So when McDonald's throws its weight around, when it's finally pushed to do so, changes happen.
Yeah.
Just like how in France they're using local chickens and everything.
Right.
KFC up here uses local chickens. They use Canadian chickens. It's
yeah.
the same kind of deal. And that's a good thing. So McDonald's, one, they're not that evil. They do try to be pretty good about it. He talks about the myth of how McDonald's is dirty. Everyone always says, har, har, McDonald's dirty, gonna
they
get
can't
sick,
be.
Blah, 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 blah. Ray Kroc was like a compulsive clean freak.
Yeah.
And McDonald's is still like that. They have incredible cleanliness standards.
I worked there. You could eat off the floor. It was clean.
Exactly.
You know why it's clean? Because if it's not clean, you get shut down. And do you know what happens if you get shut down? You don't make money. So you know what?
You franchise and you pay a lot. You have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars just to apply for a franchise now.
Exactly.
It's not like you put your money up like a DP Doe franchise. You put your money up, you're good to go. Just to apply for McDonald's franchise is expensive, let alone the rest of it.
Right.
So,
well, and then there's like the urban legend. I know we've probably covered this before, but I just want to throw it in that they use like grade F meat, or that the name of the company is 100% pure beef and it's not actually 100% pure beef patty, blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
They can't serve you anything that you can't legally serve a human being.
Exactly.
If they did, they'd be getting shut down. That's just the way it is.
Exactly. It's a very clean establishment. Nobody's spitting in your food at a McDonald's.
No.
Talking about about that, apparently George Orwell wrote something, Down and Out in Paris and London. And he talked about working at a high-end restaurant, and people laughed at him for washing his hands before he touched food. And the quote was, roughly speaking, the more one pays for food, the more sweat and spittle one is obliged to eat with it. He wrote in 1933, and this has been backed up by present-day chefs, researchers, and writers who have worked or otherwise observed in kitchens in independently owned restaurants, where, as Orwell put it, employees had no orders to be genuinely clean, and in any case, no time for it. I'm sure some of that's changed, but think of Fight Club.
Oh my.
Anyone's gonna mess with you, it's because you have money and you're being pretentious. Whereas McDonald's, they're just doing their jobs.
I don't know. I've never worked in a high-class establishment. No. I've always worked in, you know, regular restaurants. And we were always
super clean.
Oh, yeah. And it's a peer pressure thing, too. You know, anybody that's working in a restaurant, they are doing their best. And they want to be seen as they're doing a good job. And the worst thing that can happen to you if you work in a restaurant is get a reputation for having a poor work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
So other people around you are going to shore you up or ship you out. Same thing with cleanliness. They will not tolerate it. Your coworkers will not tolerate you being a filthy pig and being horrible to people's food, because it could be us out there ordering it.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that it's just wrong.
Mm-hmm. But McDonald's, it's because they're so crazy about their meat. When was the last time you heard about a McDonald's with a tainted meat scare?
I can't even think of it.
It's been Jack in the Box, it's been White Castle, it's been all these other places. I've never heard of a McDonald's with tainted meat.
No, you're right.
I never hear them mentioned. You have a better chance of getting sick from food poisoning in a mom-and-pop place than you do at McDonald's. Crazy, but true.
Okay.
So on to more McDonald's defense. It's insane. We
right.
slam well, it.
I see where it comes
boy,
from, though,
but
because you see the slacker teenagers working there part-time or for mm-hmm. the summer. And that's where people, I think, get the idea that it's going to be substandardly prepared.
Mm-hmm. He talks about labor in McDonald's as well, that people slam it because of the labor, but nonetheless, they actually hire a mix of staff. It's not just kids.
Yeah.
They have older folk and kids working there, like moms and people who are like our age now.
Yeah.
And there's this image presented of McDonald's workers being just miserable and unmotivated and slack-jawed and stupid and slow-witted.
What?
And it's not true. Most of the employees are really happy. He talks about, let me see if I can find it really quick. He calls Eric Schlosser out in this too, which makes me really happy. It was really cool. Similar work, different food. Ah, Laurie Anderson, it was a performance artist who worked at McDonald's for a while for a piece she was working in 2002. And she expected to find the slack-jawed, miserable, oppressive corporate regime. She said it was the exact opposite. Everybody had fun. They took a lot of pride in their work and were genuinely happy. They worked really hard because they wanted their times down low for the drive-thru.
Yeah.
And she was shocked. She said that people took pride in their work there. And it reminds me of the stories you told me. And it reminds me of working at Burger King, even when I was a teenager. We were kids, but we had a lot of older folk. When I worked with the one morning crew that was mostly the older regular workers, everyone took a lot of pride in their work. Nobody was going to serve something that was substandard. We might grumble a little bit when the one little old lady used to bring her burger back for like the sixth time because it wasn't hot enough. I mean, we would heat it up for her so hot that it would burn to carry it to the tray. And she still said it wasn't hot enough. Like, for the love of God, lady, here's what's happening. You're so old, your taste buds don't work anymore, so you can only taste heat. All right? You're scalding everything off of your mouth. Just
it's a vicious cycle.
Eat a yogurt.
Or put some hot sauce on it or something.
Something.
I don't know.
But, you know, we would grumble, but we wouldn't do anything to it.
No.
So it,
God, no.
And everybody was pretty happy to work there. I enjoyed working there.
Yeah.
Not saying I want to be a professional burger flipper for the rest of my life. But he talks about how the employees is looked down on as the lowest of the low in terms of professions. But it's really not that bad.
No.
It's an interesting defense of McDonald's. There was one more defense he made that I really have to say I understand that. He compares it to In-N-Out Burger, which I've never had, but I've heard about it.
I've never even heard of it. What
In-N-Out
is it?
Burger is supposed to be, I think it's a West Coast thing. It's supposed to be fast food fresh. It's okay. An anti-fast food place. They make everything fresh. It's they only have a couple things in the menus, like old school McDonald's. They have burgers, French fries, they have double cheeseburgers, and that's pretty much it. The 4x4, four slices of patties and four slices of cheese.
Sounds good.
Yeah, fresh potatoes, that's all they serve. It's supposed to be so good they serve it at, like, Vanity Fair movie star parties and stuff like that. And the difference is that when you walk in there, it's, like, all young people working. They're all working at just, like, a breakneck speed. You go to McDonald's, it's a more manageable speed. It doesn't get too crazy all the time.
Yeah.
And McDonald's gets slammed for its nutritional value and how bad everything is for you and how high the calorie content, fat content is. In-N-Out gets a free pass because it's fresh and it's the alternative and it's someplace you can take your kids and not feel like you're catering to the evil empire and you're giving them
right.
their money. Whereas In-N-Out food is just as bad for you.
But it makes you feel better eating it.
It makes you feel better eating it.
You're sticking it to the man.
Exactly. And they say, oh, it's great because they pay their workers a little bit more. Okay, that is great.
Yay.
But they still don't get a free pass for that.
Yeah.
So, interesting stuff with that. See if there's anything else I wanted to relate in terms of...
This is kind of a related thing. It's like how people will always drink the... They think that they can just go ahead and drink as much of the carbonated fruit juice as they want instead of drinking pop.
Yes!
But
it's just bad for you. There's just as much sugar.
It's just as much sugar and it's just as much calories. Yes, there is vitamins in it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if you're looking at just strictly for calories, juice is not a zero-calorie drink.
No.
You know? It's really, really good, but you probably shouldn't drink gallons and gallons and gallons of it, because you'll probably rot your teeth out of your head, just the same as if you're drinking pop, right? Mm-hmm. The only difference is you won't get scurvy, because there's tons and tons of vitamin C.
No. There's another place, Oh Naturals, that's kind of doing the same thing that In-N-Out's doing. It's fresh food, fast kind of deal.
Right.
Kind of like Boston Market. But it's really just to make people feel better about what they're getting. It costs more than McDonald's, and you're supposed to feel better about it than going to McDonald's. But McDonald's offers a place for, one of the points he made earlier in the chapter is McDonald's offers a place for homeless people to go.
Yeah.
You can buy two things off the dollar menu, and you have someplace warm to sit. Somewhere warm, you can sit, get out of the cold, and just sit for a little bit without being bothered.
Yeah. So, I thought that should be your motivation for opening up.
No.
A restaurant, but I can see the point socially.
Yeah.
You know.
The dollar menu, which is something we don't really have up here.
We have,
like, the value menu, but it's not the same. The dollar menu, if you're really, really tight on cash, it is almost cheaper than cooking.
But it's not.
Well, for one person, it can be, though.
Okay, fine.
Because don't forget, you have that whole exponential thing. It's cheaper to cook en masse than it is for one person.
Okay.
Unless you're willing to worry about things going bad because you cook a recipe before that can't be scaled down. It's cheaper to go to McDonald's and get a dollar burger than it is to go and get a pound of ground meat and portion it out and buy the bags and then buy the buns and have to worry about the buns and everything thawing or
okay, fine, but it's not cheaper to feed a family of four.
No it's not, but it not to the point where they'd be full. But if you're a single person who's got, you know, $20 a week for grocery money, it's an affordable treat.
Okay, I will give ground on that.
And
so what's next?
This segues into a different gear completely now. He goes into the last third of the book, which is about obesity, which I find ironic is after the McDonald's chapter, because McDonald's is slammed for obesity, because obviously everybody who's fat only eats McDonald's.
Right.
Because we've established how much I adore McDonald's and how much I eat there every day, but I'm still a fat slob.
I can't remember the last time we actually ate at McDonald's.
You had a burger there a couple weeks ago, but actually eating a meal at McDonald's, it's been a couple months.
Yeah.
This thing was on the way to your mom's the one day. We had done our grocery shopping, and we hadn't stopped to eat anything yet. And we ran through McDonald's and got some stuff in the drive-thru. And then we looked across the street and realized we could have gone to the fish and chips place and said, oh.
Anyway.
So, obesity. Now, this is the one where pull out your salt cellar. Because I needed to grind some salt, too, for this. I don't know how much of this to trust. He makes some great points. He's reinforcing some things I've read lately as well. But we don't know what makes people fat. You can make the argument of, we'll just put down the Twinkie fatty. Yes. However, why can the person next to me eat the Twinkie and not get fat?
And sit around and play just as many video games as you do, if not more.
Exactly. We just don't know. We know there is some kind of relation with calorie consumption, but it's not across the board.
Right.
We know that 3,500 calories, the energy produced by 3,500 calories is the energy, same energy as a pound of flesh, pretty much. We know that. You eat 3,500 calories, in theory, you should gain a pound. That's all we really know. We don't there's an amazing number of hypotheses that you would put forth in this. And it's, wow. It could be due to genetics, like we've thought. It could be just that metabolism and genetics play a huge role. It could be to what we're eating. It could be to some of the chemicals in the food. It could be to, believe it or not, they've actually hypothesized that it's a virus. There's like an obesity virus that you get that makes it harder for you to burn fat than the next person. They put forth in here a nice theme that goes throughout the whole thing is exercise and eating less alone will not make you keep your weight down if you're meant to be fat. That doesn't mean you can eat with abandon and get to be a blimp size. And just to put this straight on the record, we're not talking about people who are on the Freak Channel. Some of those people, you know, like A&E, the TLC, the channels where they have the nonstop rotation of people who need to be crane lifted out of their houses and how it happened. Some of those people have serious medical conditions that have caused it. Some people had other issues. They were just big in general, and they just got bigger because
they couldn't exercise, so it became a vicious cycle.
Exactly. But we just don't understand it. And yes, American obesity has ballooned out through the roof, and we're saying, well, it's fatty food, it's bad food, it's all this rich food we eat. But then why, when it was low, were we eating things like meatloaf and fried chicken and whole milk and butter whipped potatoes and having
wild abandon?
Eating the classic 1950s foods?
Chicken fried steak.
Why is it that our generation is horribly obese and the baby boomers aren't as bad and they're the ones that grew up with all the bad food?
Yeah. I mean, exercise is good.
We're the ones watching fat content. We're the ones watching our calories like crazy. We're the ones being careful and eating greens and fiber and all that, but we're fatter and fatter all the time. Hmm. Is it how much
we're eating? Is it stress, maybe?
Is it stress? Again, another thing that's put on. Dieting. They did a study. There you go. Take a drink. Then girls who dieted were fatter.
Well, and I can totally believe that.
That's a no-brainer. You're fat. You're going on a diet. But people...
No, because people go off of it.
The younger the dieters, the younger they started dieting, the fatter they got in life later on. Of the group, the biggest girl in the group that they studied was the heaviest one because she... the heaviest girl was the one who went on the diet the earliest at a youngest age. And I'm just floored.
Like, what age did she start dieting at?
Under 14.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Your body's still growing. You need those nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I have some pretty differing opinions about diet. I mean, if you want to make a lifestyle change...
Just 1 second. Over the years, 3 years, the researchers followed the kids. The dieters in the sample gained more weight than the non-dieters and were more likely to engage in binge eating.
See, it's totally psychological. Like, if you decide, okay, I'm going to be vegetarian or I'm only going to consume this much calories a day and make it a lifestyle change and realize that you're going to eat this way until you die to bring your weight to something that you want, that's fine. But diet immediately means it's temporary in your own mind. As soon as you say I'm going on a diet, you already know that you're only going to be doing it for so long. And which is why I never go on diets, because
it doesn't do anything.
It doesn't do anything. And then when people come off of diets, they totally binge because they're like, well, screw it. I fell off my diet wagon. I'm going to go eat a dozen donuts. And they fall off the wagon even harder.
Exactly.
Which means they gain even more weight, which means they find another diet to try and go on. Which means it just becomes a vicious, vicious cycle.
Well, you know how I said they hypothesize that it may be something you catch? It's could be caused by microbes. Ulcers, we know, are caused by bacterium. Diet could be caused by something else like that. Pathogens have been implicated in heart disease. We do know when people were in groups, they eat more.
Yeah.
When you go to a church social, you eat more than if you eat by yourself.
There's
Who knows
a bunch
if
of
you're
social...
catching something else like
well,
that?
There's a bunch of social... It's very, very... It's a complex thing. There's lots of different factors. You know, like you said, there's, you know, the physiological factor, there's genetics, there's your environment, there's... how you feel, your own psychological place where you are. There's socially where you are, you know.
Now, to bring also into this, why do we care so much about whether or not we're fat?
Dogs don't care.
Dogs are like, yeah, give me a bowl of grease and I'm gonna lap that stuff up. But why do we care so much? Health?
I mean, it should be your health, right? But then...
This is so cool. Obesity doesn't really cause health problems. No, we're not talking about, again, the Freak Show Channel obesity of you can't walk anymore. We're talking about the obesity of you and I. People our size or a little bit less than us. There is no consistent evidence that obesity causes heart disease. There is no clear connection between it at all.
Really?
Really.
Hmm. Get a dozen donuts and sit in front of the Heart and Stroke Disease Foundation and eat them.
Well, they found there's no clear connection. There's no clear connection between, or something else here. No, we know diabetes is related to obesity.
And it doesn't mean that, like, you should pack on as much weight as you possibly can until your knees blow out, right?
Exactly.
Your joints are affected by your weight. Your blood sugar and everything, that is also affected by your weight and the amount of fat that you're carrying.
He also talks about the taking the smokers out of the study again, because there's one study that found obesity and cardiovascular disease for nurses. And they had taken a sample of women, all nurses, because they wanted them all to be under the same stress kind of deal, all white,
right.
And they took out all the smokers. Of the 115,195 women in the study, only 184 were non-smokers.
Wow.
Oh no, only 184 were non-smokers who died of cardiovascular disease during the 16 years of the study. That gave it a 60% increase in the death rate.
Wow.
Because they took out all the smokers.
Well,
sounds crazy.
Doesn't it? Job.
Sounds crazy, but really, you're skewing your data left and right.
Right.
It's
skewed if you leave it in, but it's even more skewed if you take them out. And it doesn't really surprise me that even though they're health professionals, a high amount of nurses smoke because it is a stressful job.
Mm-hmm.
And even just being able to stop for a second, that's how North Americans allow themselves to stop for a minute. That's like the only way is if you're a smoker. I myself am a non-smoker, but I am jealous about the amount of smoke breaks that smokers get when you work any place.
Which he also hypothesizes on smoking in the obesity rate, that in the past, most people are stress eaters. Most people, when they get stressed, they will eat.
Well,
in the past,
comfort food,
when
right?
smoking rates were high, when you got stressed, you smoked. Now we're not doing that. We're eating instead because we can't smoke. It's bad for us. Which it is. I'm not proposing smoking. Please
not
don't say that.
It's not.
It's very bad for you.
Bad
we're non-smokers, but nonetheless, people, when they got stressed, they smoked. Now we're eating. That may subtly be contributing to the rise in obesity. He asks, why are we so much fatter now?
Yeah.
It could be that. It could also be that there was a, when you look at how you classify obese and overweight, there was a large number of people who were just under the overweight categorization.
Yeah.
And when you change some of those levels, it bumps everybody up.
Yeah.
So it's just everyone's almost the same size. It's just we've bumped it up. And there's still always those outliers. That my personal theory, and this is something we've talked about in regards to the internet in general and modern media, is that we're so well connected now and we see everything around us that now we see all of these fat people that we never saw before because we can't. Because
we weren't going to
we
malls.
We have people of Walmart.com where it's showing nothing but fat people. At Walmart all day.
Right.
You know?
And at the same time,
you think America's full of fatties.
Right. Well, at the same time, the average size and the look of people that are in the media are changing. And I don't want to go too much into this, but if you look at actors from movies from the 70s, they weren't necessarily attractive skinny or average-sized people. Sometimes they were being, you know, real thin.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they were pleasantly plump. Sometimes they were nice-looking. Sometimes they were downright hideous.
Yeah.
But they showed everybody, you know, whereas now we only have pretty in-shape people to hold ourselves up against.
And we know two things for sure. Healthy people that are of a higher weight don't die any more frequently, don't have a higher rate of death. We all have. There's 100% death rate, let's face it.
Right. No one gets out alive.
Yeah. But healthy people who lose weight do not live longer. Healthy people with a little bit of extra poundage actually do better in the long run. We're not talking about diabetes, but yo-yo dieting can damage your immune system. It can cause heart disease.
It can damage your organs, too.
It can damage all kinds of stuff. So going crazy with the dieting is not going to help you. We also know, binge eating causes weight gain. We know there's a correlation between income and obesity. We also know, and I've been reading this almost right out of the book, this is amazing, that if binge eating causes weight gain and the connections between income, that means people of a higher income aren't binge eating. People of a lower income, it may just be that when you have the food, you eat it because you may not know when the fridge is going to be full again. And when it gets close to payday and there's not much in the fridge, you are eating less. Your calorie consumption is lower. And you are following a natural pattern of binge eating right there.
Yeah.
And that may be what causes obesity in lower classes. It's not McDonald's. It's the fact that when you get paid, you go out and treat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you go get the McDonald's super value thing and you gorge on 4,000 calories in one day because you have the money. And then as you get to the end of that 2-week period, you're very light on cash. So you're eating closer to 1,500 calories a day. And you're following a natural cycle. We know from studies done in the Holocaust, now this isn't in the book, that the best way to get Holocaust survivors, the best way they found to get Holocaust survivors to gain weight was binge eating. Binging
and starving.
And starvation. That will cause you to gain weight faster than anything else.
Right.
We know that there has been an increase in poverty in America in a way. Could this be what's causing it?
Maybe. I mean,
we don't know.
If I can say anything about the human race, we are very good at surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And
that also ties into the natural mechanism that we have.
That's
part of the survival gene, that you eat So when there's no food, when you can't hunt and gather, you have it.
Right. Yep. So that even if you didn't have any money and you couldn't eat, you know, a couple days before payday, you wouldn't keel over dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't be able to not go to work. You'd be unhappy about it.
Yep.
People can survive for a long time without food. It's incredible and very sad, you know. You can go for 3 minutes without air. Mm-hmm. You can go for 3 days without water. But you can go for 3 weeks without food. I mean, you're going to be in horrible condition by the time.
You can.
But you can. You can survive, and then you can be, you know, with the right medical treatment,
brought back to resembling life.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. I mean, that would be horrible to be trapped someplace where you had no access
to any food for 3 weeks, yeah.
But you would survive,
most likely. You may be missing a few teeth, but you'll make it. But you put it into that kind of stream of thought, and it makes a whole heck of a lot of sense.
I was thinking, historically speaking, like, up until, you know, probably the 1950s, when we have this age of plenty, it was always feast or famine for the human race, you know? There's always been, you know, times when they were lean, and times when the crops came in, and you sucked yourself, because that way, when the times were lean, at least you had a couple extra pounds that you could live off of, right?
Yes, but the upper classes, the fridge is never empty. You never have to wait till payday to go grocery shop, and you can't say, well, we have to eat what's here, because I can't pick anything else up.
Yeah.
So there's no decrease. There's always chips in the cabinet, and everyone's eating a regular amount all the time. I'm not saying that's exactly what it is,
right.
But I have to wonder if that's a correlation. I have to kind of think maybe that's part of what's causing it.
It could also be stress related as well.
And we also know that from the mid-1800s, on average, we've gained 4 inches up.
Yeah.
And we haven't adjusted those
charts.
Well,
that's the thing is, like, I hate BMI, because if you're going to tell me about how much fat I have in my body, then at least give me an approximation about how much my skeleton and muscle weighs, and then look at how much percentage fat I have.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now you're only looking at my height. And, well, I am built like a brick poop house.
Yeah.
You know, I am not,
well,
even if
according to BMI,
I have a belly, and I accept that. I'm a fat chick.
Yeah.
But you know what? I'm not going to be as skinny as Paris Hilton ever.
No.
Because I got potato picking hips, I got broad shoulders, you know, my family was made to work, I guess.
But looking at BMI, you and I are in the same category as the people on the freak show that need lifted out of the house in a crane.
Right.
I do not think either one of us are in that bad of health. I don't think either one of us are in that bad of shape.
Hmm.
We could still climb the stairs at ease, two at a time.
Yeah.
We still walk all over the place. We still do all kinds. We kayak. We hike.
We're active fat people.
We're active fat people. We're healthy people. So
Right. It's
not necessarily, BMI is not a good indication.
No.
Talk to your doctor, see if you're healthy or not, then tackle it from there.
Exactly.
And a lot of it's still genetics. And you could be thin and have bad cholesterol. You could be fat and have bad cholesterol. It's not necessarily what you're eating. So kind of switching gears to the conclusion, I just wanted to cover one thing. There's also a bogus study out there, and I've heard it lots before. I've heard it on TV shows, like sitcoms and dramas, that children who eat dinner with their families perform better in school. You have to have family dinner, rah, rah, family dinner. Everybody sit down, dad at the head of the table, mom at the other end of the table. You sit down with food on the table and you eat. That is bogus. And it's quoted as being a study from the National Merit Society. So Mr. Glassner wrote them because he wanted to track this down. Here's their reply. This is so beautiful. Dear Professor Glassner, we have also seen references of this study in various articles over the last 10 to 12 years. However, we have no idea of the origin of this study. All I can tell you is that it did not originate from National Merit Scholarship Corporation. No such study was ever done here. I'm sorry I cannot help you further. Good luck in locating the source. Sincerely, Eileen Artemakis, Department of Public Information, National Merit Scholarship Corporation.
So it's an urban legend.
It's an urban legend. We don't eat, as a families don't
it's a
eat together any
urban
less.
Legend.
Families don't eat together any less than they did in the 50s. They're still eating together 5 nights a week.
That one I dig totally, because you always hear, rawr, family dinner, rawr, rawr, rawr. You need to sit down and eat with your kids.
Yeah, we're already doing it. Stop, you know, belaboring the point. It's already happening. You may not be eating together at a home-cooked meal. You may be eating out, but you're still doing it.
Right.
You may be eating takeout together, but families are still eating together. The family's not in jeopardy.
Being together is what's important.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a killer book. A lot of food for thought. A lot of things that make you go, huh? A lot of things you might want to check out on your own before you swallow them wholesale. I understand that completely. There's still some things I want to check out. I still believe there is a correlation between calorie consumption and gaining weight. That's kind of a no-brainer, but it's not as strictly, oh, I'll eat fewer calories and I'll be able to drop to 100 pounds. That's
it's not as cut and dried as everybody, especially people that are trying to sell you something, make it out to be.
Exactly.
Or especially people that are in positions of power that are telling you how you should live your life. It's not as simple as they try and make it
out
to be.
There's no such thing. I didn't get into the carbs versus protein thing and steak and meat. But beef is good for you. That's one of the points he makes in there, and he's right. Beef was, it was a lower class thing from much earlier in history as to why it was being pushed away as a bad source of nutrition for, like, immigrant families and such. But beef is actually the perfect part package for receiving so many nutrients that we need. Hamburgers, in a way, are actually good for you. White Castle was right. That was one of the things in the defense of McDonald's, that hamburgers can be good for you. Pizza, right there. All the food groups, everything you want on one slice. There was a kind of like a food kitchen reach out kind of thing where the fellow was talking about, and the book was talking about how he gets just blasted all the time for serving pizza to kids there. And he said, look, I could feed them something that is healthy and tasteless, and they're going to look at the tray, and even if they're hungry, they're not going to eat it. They're not going to eat any of that stuff. I put a slice of pizza on there, and then I put a green salad next to it, and an apple, and a cookie. They'll eat the whole tray because the pizza's there. And he said, pizza's good for you. Yeah, you shouldn't eat the whole pizza, but you have dairy, you have tomatoes, you have the bread, you have a meat on it, it's another protein. Everything you want is right there. And then they're going to eat the salad because they ate the pizza, and then they're going to eat the apple, and then they're going to eat the cookie. Yeah, they shouldn't have the cookie. Oh, well. Kids need sugar. Give them sugar. So,
what's life without dessert?
Exactly.
You can't deny yourself everything.
Point. You have to sit back and say, dang, he's right. Whatever it takes to feed hungry kids, you know, do it. And try to be subversive and get a couple healthy things in there, but don't make them eat, like, nothing but spinach and alfalfa sprouts.
And liver.
And liver. That's ridiculous. This is really long. You're going to hate me because you have to edit it. I didn't think this one was going to go as long, but there's so much information in this book. Barry Glassner, The Gospel of Food. Get it from your library, Chapters, Barnes & Noble, wherever. You could probably get it for a song now used on Amazon. Yeah.
Basically, the bottom line is, it's everything killer. That you think you know, there's probably another side to that story.
Exactly.
And we still don't, as much as we like to tout that we're the top of the food chain, we're going into space, we're putting men on the moon, we don't know everything there is to know about the world yet. And as my grandmother said, nobody can know everything.
Yes. We could all laugh someday and say, wow, obesity was due to this crazy virus that came out that nobody knew about. And that's why everybody started packing on pounds and found it harder to lose. We don't know. Could be genetically you have a predisposed weight that you're going to be set to.
Yeah.
Could be that all these extra vitamins that we're piling on ourselves through enriched foods are what's causing the problem. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be crazy.
Yeah, we just don't know.
Anyway, be who you want to be.
Eat, be healthy, be happy. Moderation in all things, including moderation. This is Tracy.
And this is Sheila. Where's my Fat Chicks. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed this 5 Fat Chicks podcast. Please add us as a friend on MySpace and or Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Please email your comments, questions, or suggestions to zweifatchicks@gmail.com. That's zweifatchicks@gmail.com. Our theme music is Hot Swing by Kevin MacLeod. Our podcasts, like Mr. MacLeod's music, are protected under a Creative Commons attribute copyright. You can make copies of our shows and share them with friends, but please make sure that credit is given. Once again, thank you for tuning in, and we hope you have a great day.